Welcome back to another MLOps community podcast. This is the coffee session all about breaking into MLOps. We've had a lot of people talk to us about how they can better get into MLOps and what they need to know, how they can learn, what are the best tracks to go down. And we are talking to the expert in the field right now. It is a day with not only Vishnu, my man, but we have Salva. Please correct me if I pronounce that incorrectly.
Salva. No, that's correct. It's Salva, yeah.
Perfect. And we are planning to talk about all of these different learning paths and different landscape right now of where we're at when it comes to machine learning engineers' expectations, MLOps, and then also how one can get better in the field, especially if they already have a bit of experience, but they want to go deeper. So normally we start this off just by asking a little bit from the guest about how you got into doing what you're doing.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here this morning. So how I got into the education of the business of machine learning education, as well as, I guess, EdTech broadly. So I've been in education pretty much my entire career, but in various aspects of it. In higher ed, I've always been itching to get into EdTech. So I joined fairly early on when MOOCs were still pretty big. So I did quite a bit of work there. And what really excited me about EdTech, I guess, compared to other education avenues was the ability to make it very accessible across the globe. And I try to be careful about saying that, because often I think we just assume that if things are online, it's accessible, but there's so many different parts of the world where that's not necessarily true. And it also depends on what you're teaching and what mediums or platforms you're using. But it does get further than say a traditional physical classroom where you have to be within a certain radius. So that was definitely exciting to me.
Why is that it's not accessible? I totally thought exactly what you were saying there. And if it's online, it's totally accessible.
Because you don't have internet access everywhere, right? So being able to have internet access, and then if your online courses are video or requires you to code in browser, like those require certain abilities on your machines that's not necessarily accessible everywhere. Like, for example, I remember when I was applying to college, this wasn't that long ago, by the way, I had to literally cross town to get to a place where we would have power, A, B, there would be internet access that wasn't billed by the minute. So it wasn't dial-up internet, or actually even if it was dial-up internet, we just needed reliable power and had to kind of make sure like that was, and internet at homes wasn't that common at the time. So it had to be at an internet cafe. So when things would go online or someone would ask us like, to pay for SATs and credit cards, like that was a big hurdle for us to get over because we didn't necessarily have access to those things to be able to make it. So it actually went the opposite way where it was harder to do it. Of course, things have changed now. And this was also in Bangladesh where now it's much more different, but it definitely didn't, online didn't equate access in all cases. Yeah. And then going back to kind of machine learning education. So I'm currently the founder and CEO of Fourth Brain, and our larger mission is to bring more and more people into machine learning careers. We started this about a year and a half ago, actually right at the beginning of when COVID hit. Remember, I started this 2 hours before California, where I'm based, went into shelter in place. But a big motivation, and definitely gave me pause for about 2 hours. But what really motivated me at the time is I was watching this, a lot of people getting furloughed or losing jobs around me, including family members and friends. And meanwhile, you have this field that is growing 29% year over year, job growth. And I kept thinking, is like, there has to be a better way to make this more accessible. And the numbers right now, it looks like, I think it's about 60% of engineers who want to get into machine learning, which is great, but you also need this pathway to not just be, you have to be an engineer and then get into it, because you're just making the funnel smaller and smaller. So we want to make sure that while that may be the case now or today, that it evolves in a way that becomes, if someone knows this is the path they want to take, and we're aware of the field, that we make it easier for them to get into.
Yeah, that's so awesome to hear. And it's so great what you're doing in this way that you're helping fill the needs for not only the people who are looking for the jobs, but I know that we can all attest there's so many startups right now that are trying to fill job positions, and they can't because there's not enough people that are out there and that are able to do this. So one thing that I wanted to ask you and kind of kick off this conversation with is, I met with a community member yesterday, actually, and he is going into his first job as an ML consultant. And he's really an active learner in the community. I loved speaking with him because he was so passionate about learning all about MLOps. And he had some great questions for me. And one of them being, how can I learn more? What can I do to learn more about MLOps? I'm going into my first job, but I want to be able to make an impact when I'm in my job. And so I'm wanting to throw that question out at you and see what you would think. What would you advise someone who is trying to do that?
Yeah, no, that is such an excellent question. It's, and honestly, like communities like this, the fact they exist and that you can come to and ask questions is great. I know we need more of that, especially within ML and MLOps. But that's been a large question we've been kind of asking. We're like, people who are interested in this, where do they hang out? Like, is it Slack? Is it online? Is it Reddit? Like, where is this is coming from? And I think communities are kind of forming around this. But in terms of learning, right? So there are obviously excellent resources that are out there, whether it's open source, whether it's online courses, whether it's people getting together, kind of figuring things out on their own, reading papers, trying to apply. Like when we started Fourth Brain, like one of the things that I was fairly acutely aware of is there are a lot of good educational programs out there. So whether it's online courses or boot camps or in person, and we didn't want to recreate that. So like we sort of created this based on a hybrid learning model, and that's getting very specific down the path. But what I really meant to say is it kind of depends a little bit on individual students' motivation and needs, because there's a lot of self-paced programs that you can do or ask kind of free-flowing questions within communities like the Stack Overflow equivalents, right, of MLOps. Some of it is growing, like very ML-specific is a little hard to find, so I can see why he's asking that question. But I'm also a very big advocate for learning through mentorship or the original Socratic method of asking questions and apprenticeship, right? Like that's a big way of doing this. So one of the things we kind of do is pair people up. We call our students candidates, actually, because they're trying to focus on the job search. But for an emerging field like this, being able to kind of conduct what is an informational interview, right? Like find the person that you want to be or want to learn from on LinkedIn, and don't be disheartened if like a lot of them don't necessarily respond, because it is a little bit of a cold calling. So if you're able to find a connection, that works better. But going into it, most people are really willing to help. And that's something I think there's been a shift during COVID too, because a lot of ways we were volunteering our times in the past or learning were kind of taken away. So I know I took a lot more Zoom calls if someone reached out to me and asked, how do I get into EdTech this past year, than I did in any other way, because we didn't have those physical or in-person networking events happening, right? So you sort of replaced it with this. So take advantage of that and kind of reach out to people, but also be mindful of their time. And if someone feels like they're also helping you by giving you some guidance around it, I think there's a fulfillment there, right? So they're not necessarily waiting to say no, but reaching out and making that informational interview connection. And it's really, you're trying to learn about the other person's path and then trying to like figure out how to apply that. So doing a bunch of those has generally helped me at least narrow down what I'm trying to learn or answer any questions that I've done that quite a bit, even in my job of like, what should I build? Is this something the market even needs? Because you don't want to build something in vacuum and not have people come to it, right? So whether it's anything from like employer needs to I want to learn something to you have a really cool career, I want to know how you got there. Those kinds of one-on-one connections, I think, go a long way in terms of figuring out what you want to learn.
I love what you said there about trying to find, you know, the person that you want to become. Mm-hmm. And talking to them. I think that that's great advice. I think that's something that has been very helpful for me, and something that I you know, I kind of wish I had more time to do, you know,
right.
You know, taking a real look at career paths and talking mm-hmm. to the people that have experienced them and learning from them. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate that. My question, you know, first off, congratulations on launching this great program. It makes a lot of sense, you know, why we need this given the market mm-hmm. and given where, you know, I think ML education overall is. You know, I took a look at your website and what the content sort of is that is part of your curriculum. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you developed your ML ops and systems content in particular. You know, as an sort of ML ops engineer myself, it's kind of tricky. You know, it's been a process to define what that is, yes, right? Which is exactly what we all do in the community. and then to also understand what truly is state of art, what kinds of things need to be learned and what kinds of things are moving quickly right. or becoming outdated. So I'd love mm-hmm. to kind of understand your process in developing that curriculum.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll take a step back and start with how we developed a little bit on the first program, which was our machine learning engineer, and then because it kind of leads into why we did the MLOps programs next, is when we did the machine learning engineering program, and we talked to a lot of employers, because there's so many programs out there, my primary question was, why are we still having trouble filling these roles? And why are people still having trouble finding these jobs, right? That matchmaking, if you will. And what came out from my employer conversations was quite a bit of, we're missing that very last piece, the deployment piece, like the data, the modeling might be there, but that last piece was missing. And then there was also this kind of focus, again, like COVID accelerated it, but it's not temporary, are these additional skills around communication, collaboration, kind of being aware of ethics and AI and how you implement that. So we made a conscious decision to make our program very much focused on that last piece, that how do you hit the ground running? So our curriculum, regardless of the program, is kind of split into these two parts where part one, you're in a cohort with an instructor and peers. You have a live session once a week, usually on Saturdays, where you're learning much of the material. And then the rest of the week, we have curated online content where some of it is developed by ourselves. Some of it is we curate from online sources. A lot of it is deep learning AI content, since we have an exclusive partnership with them. And that's more self-paced, because I'm a big believer in, like, you don't need to be in a certain place at a certain time, especially if we're for adult learners who have other responsibilities. But you need the accountability of that kind of in-person or live session. So we combine the accountability with the flexibility. And then in the second part of the course, you're really working on this group project, because that mimics so much of what you do at a job, right? Like, you're not actually working in silos. And over time, it's also kind of become that you're communicating a lot with, whether it's business execs or non-technical folks, and you have to know what you're building to be able to communicate it that way too. So we focused on those two things. Now, when I say we built this last part, it also meant it was fairly advanced. We were very surprised to see, like, the program required 2 years of coding experience. And like I said, our mission is to bring more and more people into ML and AI careers. And we were also very surprised to see how many people we were getting that had already taken boot camps or had already taken online courses, like a significant number with many, many years of work experience, to the point that in our first course, we were asking the question, why are they in our program? Like, what is left to learn? But it really was that missing piece of, like, how do I get to the final stage of employers? And we had a lot of employers involved as well for similar reasons, which was great, because if a one-to-one ratio, it works really well, right? And then to come to your, like, in a long-winded way, to your question about the MLOps curriculum. So as this field is kind of emerging and evolving, we looked at this as, is MLOps evolving in a way what DevOps was back in the 90s, where it will come out as a field, it's more specialized, or is it going to be different, where right now, like, who's doing the MLOps work? So if you look at MLOps roles, there are not a lot of MLOps engineer roles out there, but there are quite a few kind of representative roles as well that sort of go into that angle, but they're different sort of job descriptions, which makes it even harder to figure out how people are defining it and what roles are being sought after. So when we launched the MLOps program, we noticed that even though our intention was for folks to kind of come in with a lower barrier to entry. So we require like 1 year of coding, no ML experience to come into our program. We were getting a lot of folks that already had ML engineering background. We're actually working as ML engineers that were coming in. And part of it, I think, had to do with they were trying to figure out how to implement the ops portion as a separate area within their companies, which makes sense, but they were doing it right now. So it's like the next field where if the ML engineers are doing both the modeling engineering and the ops part, but it makes more sense as the teams grow instead of just keep hiring people of the same category with the same skill set, extract ops and make that more specialized, right? So then we're kind of looking at our curriculum and saying, okay, are we talking about maintenance or quality assurance or when you look at the pipeline, is it the beginning of the process where it's the data pipelines or is it afterwards when it's the model and the maintenance at the end, right? So we made the conscious decision to actually focus on the first part for now in the program, again, to make it easier for folks to come into this role. And we realize we're maybe a little ahead or kind of early in this process as those roles are kind of becoming more formalized. But folks will be ready as they're trying to look at this. And my hope is also that this is going to be a way for people to come into machine learning as a whole, as a career path, without having to go backwards. So it's almost counterintuitive when we say that if you qualify for MLOps first, absolutely take that because that requires 1 year of coding and machine learning engineering requires 2 years. But if you qualify for both, a lot of people take ML engineering first and then MLOps second. It's hard to get that messaging across, actually, but that's kind of how we're seeing it evolve.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense. You know, I think a lot of, you know, members in the community have experienced the same level of uncertainty over, you know, number one, your role at, you know, at your own company, right? In mm-hmm. terms of, is my job putting out models or is my job, you know, getting models into production, so to speak, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And then I think, you know, secondarily, you know, in the job hunt process, I am seeing the title MLOps engineer a lot more, right. You know, particularly in the last quarter. Yes. And because I write the Demetrius and I write the job section of our newsletter, we look at a lot of jobs postings, probably hundreds a year. But it's still not necessarily common, you know, and a company that is looking to hire an MLOps engineer mm-hmm. is probably, you know, a top 10 percentile, you know, kind of company mm-hmm. in terms of their understanding of ML and ML engineering and MLOps. Mm-hmm. Right. So kind of based off your answer there, I'd love to understand, you know, where Fourth Brain is now, you know, how many mm-hmm. students have gone through the program and, you know, what's next, you know, in terms of your overall offering.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're on our fifth cohort right now. We started in October of last year. So we haven't actually hit our 1 year mark just yet. And we have two products out there, the Machine Learning Engineering Program and the MLOps and Applications Program. And we started off with kind of focused, because our cohorts right now are in the Pacific time zone, mostly US, although by doing this on live sessions instead of in person, we did introduce like pretty much students across the US. We have some international students. And actually what's exciting, like up until now, I know our time zones were not very non-US friendly because of the Pacific time zone. We're considering the option of potentially doing something that's more international zone friendly. So probably will be more aligned towards the EU time zones in December. So that should be exciting. And a lot of our students that have gone through in the first cohort that graduated, we kind of went to this hypothesis that folks are going to want the right job rather than any job right out of the gate. We've been pleasantly surprised to actually see students were getting or candidates were getting roles even during the program, as well as post-program. And it's kind of funny, like one thing I don't have to worry about with this field is motivation, right? People are very intrinsically self-motivated. So when folks were getting roles halfway through the program, I remember external stakeholders, including investors, would often ask me, like, they're not going to finish the program then, right? Like, they're done. The goal's done. I'm like, no, the goal is not done. The goal here is learning. They're definitely going to finish the program. I'm not concerned about it because this is an investment into not just this role, but all the future ones. And I was right. Like, that was not a concern. We haven't had a single student that said, I got my job. I'm done. I'm going to leave. Like, no, they all stayed on and completed it. So they're currently getting roles and we've had people hired into companies like Amazon, Stitch Fix, Nike, There's quite a few, I'm sure I'm forgetting off the top of my head, but they also all end up in machine learning role specifically, because that's what they're coming to do, right? So it's not just a company or a role. It's literally like the next level up that they're coming in for. So they come in for like multiple reasons, whether it's a role in machine learning or a promotion or trying to take on projects within their existing role, basically doing their current job better. And sometimes even like entrepreneurial self-learning reasons as well. We have quite a few, as you can imagine, entrepreneurs within the program. So it's been very exciting to see all the different places that they're going. And they're coming back to say, now we want to hire, which is great. So that gap of like you go from candidate to hiring manager is actually quite fast because of how kind of tight-knit or small the group, the community is, including companies that are also saying, you know what, we hired somebody who's great. We like the way this program is working. So we're going to come back and start to sort of source more candidates for our roles. And like you said a little bit, that when companies are implementing machine learning, right, there are a lot of mid-size, not so much the large size, but I would say mid-size companies that are now getting into like, oh, we need to implement AI and ML. And so when they start off, they may hire like kind of a leadership role who's tasked with implementing this organization. Their first few hires tend to be ML engineers, but as they expand, then it gets into more specialized ML ops and other roles.
That's so good to hear, especially the closing the loop. And I know a lot of people are trying to do that. And it's the promise of most boot camps, right? Like, hey, do this boot camp and we'll get your job. And so it's nice to see that it's happening. And I know the market right now is super hot. And like we said earlier, there's just a ton of job openings out. One thing that I wanted to know is, where do you feel like students have the most trouble, in which section of the course, more specifically the ML Ops course? Like, where do you feel like it's the hardest piece? And maybe to give a bit of background, you can give us just a quick roadmap of what the course is, and then point out some of the snags that students have along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. That is an excellent question. So it is a little bit of what you were saying earlier, that how do you define this? What are companies looking for? Because it's not a it is well-defined now, but I guess the adoption piece is still happening. So when someone says, I want to work at this company at this role, trying to understand what that job entails, and am I actually learning the exact skill set? So we've had students kind of come in with like, this is what I do at my job. Can you teach me that, right? And which gets into, of course, complexities around like, and we've been thinking about this too. We're like, okay, it's not a course for a specific like it's not a corporate training course, which would be different. It would be customized exactly that way. But how can we make it such that you can implement or figure out what you need to learn on the job and then kind of customize it accordingly? So, and there's also those levels, right? Like of the mastery of the MLOps at the level 0, level 1, level 2, and then trying to kind of understand, where does my role currently fall? Where can I get to in the timeframe of this course? And then how do I implement it in the job that I'm being tasked with? And sometimes those jobs are also, like you said, that individuals within the companies are trying to implement this. So they're trying to understand, like, it's not just they've been given a well-defined, you're going to be at level 1, so go figure that out. It's they're trying to figure out how to implement MLOps as well. So some of it goes into that, where our MLOps is a 12-week program and our machine learning engineering is a 16-week program. So it's a very intense, dense 12 or 16 weeks, but at the same time, it is a finite amount of time, right? So what do you produce that can be showcased, that can be practiced? And you are also paying attention to things like working in a group or actually showcasing the project at the end to employers and getting feedback on that. So kind of marrying the two and figuring out like what level your own project should live at is something I think students try to like. I wouldn't say it's the most challenging, but it's the most uncertain in some ways. Like, some people get super excited about that, and that's literally where they want to get started and can't wait for part two to start. And there are others who obviously are apprehensive about that. They're pitching it. They may want to modify it, and there's a finite amount of time to do that within.
So as far as this confusion around the whole space and the job titles.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen any trends? I mean, we talked earlier about how some people are starting to recognize or call mm-hmm. the job postings MLOps engineers. But mm-hmm. I know I've seen job postings of just everything across the rainbow, whether it's like a, what are some of them? I mean, Vishnu also knows a lot of great ones because he's more head in the weeds with the job postings, but mm-hmm. you know, like senior data infrastructure for ML engineer, mm-hmm. or like what are like senior backend ML platform yeah. engineer.
Mm-hmm.
You get people asking backend, you get people saying platform engineer, you get people saying mm-hmm. infrastructure engineer, you get ML ops, you get ML engineer, mm-hmm. ML focused engineer, software engineer, ML.
ML, yeah. sciences.
I think you've seen solutions engineer, ML tech yeah. manager, which was a new one for me. And then even DevOps on ML teams, I think.
Yeah, well. Yeah, it's yeah. all over the place.
And we just were talking to Niall last week about like this kind of SRE role for machine learning, or as Diego put it, the MLRE. And
that so kind of makes sense, right? Because there is like a maintenance component to this. So it kind of makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. We're trying to start that one. That one's actually, we're advocating for that role to exist. But that's what I'm wondering is like, with all of this confusion,
mm-hmm.
how can you make sure that when someone is applying for a job, like you said, they're mm-hmm. trying to get the right job.
Right.
How do they know if it's the right job when they go through this course and they start to look mm-hmm. at these job descriptions and they say, is that me or is it not right. me? Do mm-hmm. I need more or if, yeah. is what I have sufficient?
Yeah. So one thing we're starting to do right now is we're going to do open houses exactly to address this, is we also don't want like one of the, like I come from a admissions background as well. And admissions really isn't to me about keeping students out, but more saying, I try to serve the student that would come to me and say, I invested all this time and energy. I wasn't ready, didn't have the prereqs. So this wasn't like, this was sort of a waste of my time and energy. That's what we're trying to avoid, right? So we want to make sure the candidates coming in, it's the right fit and it is what like the learning goals are aligned, right? So what we're starting to do during open house is actually showcase what a sample project would look like what you will get at the end of the course, rather than focusing on just the beginning, so that people coming in there, they don't have to necessarily think, oh, I should be able to do this today, but I will be able to do this at the end of my 12 weeks. But if that's not the level you're looking for or the depth you're looking for, then you kind of know, like, okay, wait. And that's something I think that even in jobs to some degree. With jobs, it's a little bit harder because it's not a finite period, right? Like you grow into the role, it keeps going. They can mostly tell you what the entry, like when you're entering, what skill set you have to have. But I think that kind of showcasing what a sample like project or work or looks like would be a nice way for candidates to do that, which is exactly what we're starting to do. And kind of going back a little, because you were also asking like what the program does, is we sort of look at the whole like pipeline, right? But focusing on obviously the CI/CD pipeline, but the focusing on the beginning of it or the maintenance of it. So we look at the model prototypes and then look at ML use cases. So whether it's e-commerce, NLP, computer vision, a few of those, and then apply that deployment on the cloud platforms, and also look at sort of like rapid prototyping of the tools and software that are required to maintain those pipelines. And then how do you do the monitoring in build and production stages? So it's quite a few, I would say, tools and software to some degree to be able to kind of, which makes it a little bit easier to get into this area is what the MLOps part focuses on. And then our machine learning engineering is much more open-ended in terms of being creative around what's the project you want to work on, and then you build the models from scratch. An analogy I sometimes use is it's kind of like building a robot and then having a console to go with it. So building the robot to me is the machine learning engineering part. And then the console that you use to control it is our MLOps program. Doesn't mean you may still be interested in kind of learning how to make the console work, but using the console or the controller is actually an easier way to sort of control the robot, even if you didn't build it.
That makes total sense. Now, with, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, what the boot camp experience is like, and how ForceBrain really helps make sure that, you know, people that want to get into ML are able to do so with the skills that they need to get jobs. I'm kind of curious, you know, for, you know, a lot of us, you know, like me, let's say, we're in jobs that are in ML. But there's a constant notion of needing to upskill, right? You know, the tool of today is not the tool of tomorrow, you know. Before there are older AWS products, there are newer AWS products, you know. Right. Docker's in fashion one day, Docker's not in fashion the next day. And so I'm kind of curious, from your perspective, you know, you've been at Udacity, you've been involved with, you know, sort of technical education for quite some time now. How would you advise the, you know, modern software or ML engineer to upskill without going insane? Right. Because sometimes it feels like it for me.
Sometimes it feels like it, yeah. There's two ways I kind of see this. So we sort of also, when building ForceBrain, that was something I was acutely aware of, is I wanted to be built this in a way where there is this notion of returning students, right? Like, you may upskill right now. So even though I'm saying this is the most advanced program, I know in a year or two, that's not going to be the case. We're going to have to add things at the end because the field would have gone on further. What I really like about that tech online space, though, is there is this view towards constant feedback and improving, right? So people are not disillusioned when they're creating these programs that, oh, I'm going to create this once and you're done, which, unfortunately, in a lot of higher ed institutions used to be that way. You create one and it just stays there for 10 years, right? With minor changes maybe once in a while. Here, I think no one is thinking that. They know this is going to get outdated very quickly. So going from like one cohort to the next, it changes. Or even in the middle of the cohort, like if you're getting enough feedback, there's no reason to wait until the end, right? Like if there is kind of agreement there, that needs to happen too. In terms of like trying not to go insane with this constant upskilling, I see it sort of happening two ways. One is when you complete a program, you could go out and kind of apply that for a while before you come back to the next. And that's kind of how I conceived of this as well. Like if I had to think about it, taking someone, let's say completely non-technical all the way up to machine learning engineer, in my mind is, let's say, this is kind of arbitrary, like a two-year program. So it almost sounds like a master's degree, right? But in this model of like constantly applying, like you don't want to be 2 years in a program and not having done this in real life, because there's a lot of things to be learned during the application stages too. Is if you were to break it up, I almost see it as like four parts to it, but four parts doesn't mean four semesters and you're done. It's you do a piece, let's say it's just basically intro to ML and AI. You just even decide whether this is for you. You go out and kind of have a role, whether it's an internship or something adjacent, to sort that out. And then you come back, take another piece of this, potentially do like a data analyst or a data scientist role. Then you do the same thing, but there are gaps in between. Maybe the next one's software engineering and then machine learning engineering, right? So it's kind of these stages. The other piece of this is the way I've seen people do it too, is instead of doing a program that's kind of intense for a while, is it's ongoing. So you dedicate a certain number of hours a week. So for example, the 20% rule that Google uses, I used to implement the same for my team at Udacity. And I've seen people utilize it many different ways, whether it's 1 day a week they spend entirely learning, or it's 1 hour a day, and then they divide it up that way. But it heavily dependent on people's learning styles, right? But that way, you know, you're kind of always learning, but in a more lighter mode. But when it comes to time to like really doing something a little bit more intense, or kind of changing roles or changing, I wouldn't go as far as to say changing fields, but taking like that one level up, then it tends to be that. And that's probably where bootcamp's idea or notion also came from to some degree, is you have an intense period. but there are also places where the boot camps didn't necessarily always work, where people were also wary of it being too intense or too short a period of time and not learning any of the theory behind it and only doing the application, which then prevents you from being creative and trying to do something that's a little bit different from what you learned in the program. But yeah, I think this idea of like going intense for a bit, applying it and coming back for the next phase when you're ready, or picking the one where you're okay doing this on a constant basis, but not trying to do both at the same time and go insane is probably a safer bet.
So I'm wondering, a question that came up quite a few times with people in the community asking me this, and like, I know, which I don't know why they think that, but for some reason, I get this question quite a bit, and it has been talked about a lot in the community, actually, also, the idea of being a generalist or a specialist, and I know Alexi has talked about this idea of having T-shaped
yes,
knowledge.
So I love that analogy.
Yeah, it's great, right? And yeah. One question that came up yesterday was, should I learn a lot about serving, or should I learn a lot about SageMaker and have this really strong, deep knowledge for a tool or a design pattern? Mm-hmm. Or should I just try and stay super general and be able to go from Kubernetes all the way to modeling and doing really, really like deep modeling? And I'm wondering how you look at that. And I imagine people have asked you that one too.
Absolutely. And I'm a big fan of that T-shaped analogy of having breadth, but then also having depth in one area. Part of it, I think, also goes back to what the goals are, right? So when you, and maybe another one, not as good as the T-shaped analogy, is also thinking about how, for example, in career paths, right? It's not a ladder, it's a jungle gym kind of scenario where there's the managerial path and then you have the individual contributors or the IC paths, right? There are folks who specifically pick one over the other because that's what, knowing maybe at certain companies, those pathways look very different. There are only certain titles that come with the managerial role and maybe not with the IC role. Although companies are also getting smarter around this and saying, you know what, no, we're not going to penalize you for picking one or the other. Both will have excellent growth opportunities. But there may be cases where there are certain things that come with each role. So knowing that if you go in depth in one area, like you were saying, like whether it's SageMaker or a certain type of tool, then that's what you kind of become, this go-to person or expert at, and potentially also contribute to what the next phase of that particular tool or field might be like. But then what you do miss out on, and I shouldn't say miss out because you may be perfectly fine doing it that way, because the flip side of it is if you're staying generalist, you may have these sort of like overarching kind of ideas or be probably asked to participate in more things than an expert would be asked to, but you don't get to see the full-fledged fruition, right? You hear consultants talk about this sometimes too in their own roles, is they go in, consult with the company, but they never get to see what happens eventually. Like, did they implement it? Maybe they'll know they implemented it, but they don't get to see what happens towards the end. But you get a flavor of all these different types that way. So it works for certain folks, but for others it doesn't. And there isn't really a great way of knowing which one you would like better before you've actually tried it, right? So if you're a generalist and you're doing this and you're unfulfilled because you don't get to go that step further and become an expert, then that's probably a sign that you try your hand at being specialized. Specialization, I think, is probably a safe bet to take because that's sort of what companies or organizations have to evolve in to become more efficient, right? So even when I was at Udacity, for example, because I was in the early days when I first went in, I remember my team of instructors, they were all generalists. So they were doing things in multiple ways. So serving students, whether it's by email, by chat, by one-on-one videos. Like, there was like 7 different things that were doing. But then we looked at that and we were like, okay, this content switching is not super efficient. Some people really like one over the other. So I remember people really liked chat and there were others I couldn't get them on video to save a life. Like, no, that was just not going to happen. So we ended up, or grading, right? If you look at project grading, which is similar to universities and grading, sure, it's part of your role, but if you had to do it 7 hours a day, 40 hours a week, like, no, they were never going to get burnt out. But once in a while, it was okay. So we actually introduced this idea of like specialization, or what I call like Uberification to some degree, of the different learning paths to make that more efficient or enjoyable for folks who are doing it. So I think specialization is always going to exist, and that's going to be the next progression. But as an individual, you may enjoy the generalist part of someone who partakes in a lot more business meetings or a lot more strategies around it. And that may be right for you, but you still have to have some in-depth, and that may just be maybe your vertical part of your team, may just not be the technical part, maybe something else. But I think everybody does have to have that vertical component to it too.
It's always, you know, it seems like a trade-off, right. I think, you know, and I'm not sure it has to be. I think one of the things I want to ask you about related to this whole idea of how you learn, how you think about, you know, career progression is kind of, you know, some of the successful traits of learners that you've seen, particularly industry learners. You know, I think we hear a lot about growth mindset as being important. Yeah. I think a lot of engineers face imposter syndrome. It doesn't matter, you know, who you are, what you do, what your seniority level is, you know, you're constantly a little bit behind in this field. Right. And I think, you know, there's also some notion of being overwhelmed, you know, which I think we've talked about. So, you know, how do you counsel your, you know, students in terms of their long-term progression, you know, how to kind of, you know, manage their own learning and what kind of behaviors they should be practicing?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about whether it's the imposter syndrome or feeling like you just didn't hit the mark because people set very high expectations for themselves as well, right? So I kind of try to remember this and apply it to myself as well, is when you're learning, you may come to a point of diminishing returns. So like, for example, your optimum might be 45-minute blocks, and you may feel like, oh, I need to keep going because you're measuring yourself against productivity, but you're just not super efficient after a certain point and then coming back to it. Because the third dimension to the learning that I think we often forget is it doesn't all have to be now. Like, there's a time aspect to this, right? So yes you want to learn everything, and you will. It just won't be today, right?
So
there's
true.
Months and years involved, but we do forget that. We do forget that a lot. Which I think would help in a lot of other ways. Like, I try to remind myself, I mean, this is going to sound a little morbid, but I'm like, if you put this much stress on yourself, you're going to lose lifespan. So if you lose lifespan, you're losing time, right? And then kind of like remind myself and come back to the timeline aspect.
Oh, that's hilarious.
That's a good mental trick. It's a really good one.
Basically, you're shooting yourself in the foot by stressing yourself out because you're going to lose this time that you think you're... Yeah, I can see the logic behind that. So I'm wondering, because I was asking another member of the community just yesterday about what they recommend when it comes to MLOps trajectories and things that are important for them. And one thing that they said, they prefaced it with, I don't think you're going to like this, but a lot of this MLOps stuff is really not that much of a value add unless you're fixing the underlying problems, which are things like knowing where the data is coming from, really going deep inside of whatever the application is and figuring out why this data is coming in this form, if it's the right data that you think it is, or what it is doing, so that you can better take advantage of that. And so I was just kind of wondering, from your perspective, I know that Andrew Yang is an investor in your company, and I know he speaks a lot about this whole data-centric stuff. And so when you're putting together this course and you're thinking about these things, how does that play into the course curriculum?
So I actually see the data-centric approach in AI opening up a lot of doors or potential for MLOps. Because if you think about it, and I've had this conversation with Andrew a few times, like, why isn't the data centric part more exciting or cool? I'm like, it just might be tedious, was my first reaction to it. Like, if we may understand the purpose behind it or the importance behind it, but it also has to be exciting work. Like, I can see how you make a model and you deploy it and it's doing something is just exciting to watch, versus this notion of like, oh, I got to clean this data and it's going to just make things better. Sure, I understand it in theory, but that act of cleaning up the data is not that exciting, right? Where I see the MLOps potentially opening this up is those things, there may be tools or things that can be applied to both the data pipelines or the data-centric approach, as well as potentially drift, right? That can improve this to some degree. Because we also have this notion of like, let's kind of automate or apply tools to things that are not super exciting for us as humans to do. And then let's us take the creative, exciting parts and do that ourselves. So I don't necessarily see MLOps as sort of this wrapper that is kind of making things look pretty and nice and there's an underlying problem. I think there's a level of evolution that can happen within MLOps that actually makes the data-centric approach more efficient and more feasible for us to do rather than this thing that we're all dreading.
Yeah, excellent. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you coming on here and helping us better serve the community by getting this out there. I know that you all are doing cohorts all the time. So if anybody wants to get in touch, yes, and go through a cohort, what's the best way to do that?
Yes, so our email is info@fourthbrain.ai. So that's the best place to kind of reach out. We also keep an eye on our page and then follow us on social. We're on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. So you'll hear about info sessions and open houses coming up. So I know we have an info session this Wednesday, actually, at noon Pacific time. And there will be more of these coming up. And we have a few cohorts actually lined up. There's one for machine learning engineering in October. There's one in MLOps in November and more in December. Like I said, we're considering an international one coming up. But yeah, follow us on social. And then also for anything, email us at info@fourthbrain.ai.
Excellent. So it's not too late to jump into the cohorts. And I think that's super exciting, everything that you're doing. And I love the fact that you're doing it. I think it's really awesome that you're giving people the opportunity. You're helping just bridge the gap between those who are really excited and wanting to learn and then those who need people in their current jobs that will take over these positions and hopefully have a good head on their shoulders to be able to solve some of the problems. So that's it for today. Salva, this has been absolutely incredible. Thank you so much for joining us. And we will see you all later for another episode of the Coffee Sessions.
Thank you.